So a few comments before we really start. So today at 6:10 p.m. there will be a homework meeting to write the first homework assignment together here. It is not mandatory. You lose nothing by not coming. I'll bring cookies. I don't promise every time, but I'll bring cookies today if I don't forget. And I guess the idea is also to have an opportunity to chat informally. Okay, but the declared purpose is to write a homework assignment. Second, so what I'm going to do today, it's the introduction to the third course, which is how is what we haven't yet done in the first two courses related to quantum field theory. And I'll start with quantum mechanics. Strictly speaking, what I'm going to talk about today is completely unnecessary for the course, for quantum field theory. You can tune out, you lose nothing. Okay? On the other hand, it's such a beautiful observation, the thing that comes out here, and such a lovely computation and such a wonderful integration to path integrals that I feel it's sort of wrong not to do it if you talk about path integrals and you do have the time. And we do have the time. Okay? So please forgive me, it's completely unrelated to knot theory. So I'm going to tell you what happens to a quantum particle in a quantum harmonic oscillator. In other words, when it's hanging at the bottom of a pendulum at t equals pi over 2. Of course, pi over 2 is true for the units that I've chosen. So the mass is 1, Planck's constant is 1, and the constant of the pendulum is 1. Everything is 1. Okay? And I guess the point is that it will connect to God knows how many different topics, in particular to Gaussian integration, which we'll start later, and to path integrals, which we'll also start later. Now, I should say that I've given this talk the first time more than 20 years ago, and I've given it since a small number of further times, the last of which was probably about 15 years ago, so I really hope I remember the material. I reformatted it for the modern tech, but I actually hardly read what I've reformatted. So I hope I'll do well. Okay, so first of all, in quantum mechanics, the state of the world or of a system is determined by some function psi, the wave function, which belongs to some Hilbert space in general, but in our case, L2 of R, and it is the most wonderful thing in the world to try to understand why and how. Okay? And why is the state of the universe a vector in a Hilbert space? Well, that's the whole story. Well, that's the whole story of interpreting quantum mechanics. And it's too far outside of the topic of this course, but I sincerely and honestly recommend it. So, in my mind, it's definitely one of the top five science discoveries ever. I don't know. You can put out there maybe relativity. I don't know. Evolution, certainly. This one certainly, and I don't know, maybe you can name another two, okay? But it's truly an amazing thing, and if you end up spending some time understanding it and understanding why it forces you to completely change your conception of the universe, I really mean it, then it's worthwhile, okay? But unfortunately, it's not what I'm doing. So for me, all I have is a complex valued function, well, in L2, but you know, I'm not being too particular about analysis. So So I will not really talk about norms and things. And it's a function, it's a wave function, it describes the state of the universe, so it's a function of x, but it also depends on time, because we're talking about how the universe evolves. And it is a solution of the Schrödinger equation, written here, and let me very quickly remind you where it is coming from. So, in classical mechanics, there is something called the Hamiltonian, which is the energy of a system. And the energy of a system is, what is it? It's the momentum squared divided by twice the mass, I believe, plus the potential energy, which is some V of x, where V is the function that defines the potential energy. In our case, the mass is 1, so this is p squared over 2, and since we're talking about a harmonic oscillator, a pendulum, and the constant of the harmonic oscillator is also 1, the potential energy is half x squared. And the okay, and then in quantum mechanics, one of the big things that happen is that p gets replaced by negative d to dx, and therefore negative I d to dx, and therefore p squared becomes the Laplacian with a minus sign. So therefore, this becomes minus 1/2 the Laplacian plus 1/2 x squared, all of this acting on a function of x. This is an operator, this is the operator h replacing the classical h, and then the equation of motion in quantum mechanics becomes that d psi dt, the change in the wave function as a function of time, is negative I times the Hamiltonian times psi, and that's exactly what I wrote here. And now the question is, suppose I start with a wave function at state psi, psi zero, what will it be when it evolves under this equation at time equals pi over 2? Okay? You know, it seems like a completely random question, but the answer is beautiful. The answer is beautiful and the derivation is beautiful, so it's worthwhile. Okay, but I admit that the question in itself is not terribly beautiful. Now, much of what I will talk about is more general, so I actually already said it, but basically much of what I will talk about will work for an arbitrary potential and arbitrary time, and I think I said everything that I have said here. Okay, then, let's start solving it. So, in principle, this is the derivative of something is equal to an operator times that thing. It's a matrix equation. It's like a matrix equation. It's like df dt is equal to af, where f is a vector-valued function. And then the solution is f as a function of time is e to the at, where now I'm using matrix exponentiation, I hope. Okay? In fact, if you also have an initial condition, f of 0 is equal to f0, the solution at time t would be e to the at times f0. Okay? So, likewise, and again, this is not a class in analysis, so I'm not justifying any of the exponentiation of self-adjoint, whatever, blah, 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 operators. But I still get the answer. So, psi at time t is equal to the exponential of this I to the th, h being the Hamiltonian, psi 0 at position, at place x. And then, here I just expanded what the Hamiltonian is. So it has a Laplacian part and a kinetic energy part. Okay? Now, the two parts do not commute with each other. Had they commuted, the exponential of the difference would be the exponential of one times the inverse of the exponential of the other. But they don't commute. So I need a little lemma to tell me how to exponentiate things that don't commute, and this is the so-called Trotter product formula. The Trotter product formula says that, well, I'm formulating it for matrices and using it for operators. Okay? Well, you know, that's the privilege of not knowing any analysis. So if you have two matrices A and B, the exponential of their sum, so is, well, is the thing written over here. You look at A to the N, A divided by N, B divided by N, exponentiate both, multiply and do it N times. So basically, if A is going in this direction, B is going in that direction, then going in the diagonal direction, in the direction of the sum, can be achieved even if A and B do not commute by going a small way in the A direction, then a small way in the B direction, then a small way in the A direction, a small way in the B direction, and so on. So this is the commutative picture, but the claim is that even if A and B do not commute, this works. Okay? So a sketch of the proof is you just tailor expand the right-hand side. Okay? Or, sorry, you think that N is very big, and you tailor expand this. So this becomes 1 plus A divided by N, right? So you have 1 plus A divided by N plus things proportional to N over square, divided by N squared. The second one becomes 1 plus B over N plus things proportional to N over 2. When you multiply these two things, you get 1 plus A plus B over N plus things proportional to N over over 2 plus something divided by N squared. And then when you raise it to the nth power, you will get, I guess what I wanted to say is that these two differ by something proportional to n squared, 1 over n squared, and if you raise to the nth power, you can check that the difference becomes at most order 1 over n, so at the n goes to infinity limit, the two sides are equal. Anyway, again, this is a very sketchy proof, but the theorem is true, and let me use it. Okay? So instead of exponentiating, this, I divide it into n pieces, where n is very, very, very large, and I apply the exponential of the v part, applied to psi 0, to which I apply the exponential of the Laplacian part, again divided by n, and so on, n times. I think the formula should be clear. Okay?
Bag is flat.
Sorry?
There's a little corner that's flat.
There isn't. So now I need to understand. By the way, the direction is that it's going to get worse and worse and worse before it gets better. The formulas are going to get messier and messier and messier. But you see, so I've replaced a simple power exponentiation by 2n, well, equally simple, but 2n of them. Now I have to evaluate each one, so I have to understand how to exponentiate the operation, the operator appearing here, and how to exponentiate the operator appearing here. The operator appearing here, V, the V that appears here, is just acting as multiplication. It's a multiplication operator. If you exponentiate a multiplication operator, you just have to multiply by the exponential. Right? So e to the itv acting on zero is just e to the I, is just, so this is regarded as an operator, is equal to this, this thing regarded as a number multiplying the function. And there is a sort of Halma square here to indicate that it doesn't need a proof. But now I need to understand the exponentiation of the Laplacian, and this is a bit harder. So the claim is, if you exponentiate the Laplacian, or the Laplacian divided by 2 multiplied by I, and all of this at time t, so multiplied by t, this acting on a function psi 0, well, this should be again a function in L2, so evaluated at point x, what you get is a constant. By the way, the phrase C stands for a constant throughout the paper, throughout this handout, but every time it appears, it's a different constant. Okay? So it's a constant times, well, a messy formula. Let's read the formula. The formula is the convolution of psi zero with essentially a Gaussian, or maybe a Gaussian with an imaginary exponent. So, in other words, you integrate d, a new variable, x prime, the value of psi 0 at x prime, times a Gaussian evaluated at x minus x prime. Okay? Is the formula clear? By the way, just as an aside, it's an extremely lovely thing to figure out how this recovers classical mechanics. After all, quantum mechanics in some limit should recover classical mechanics. And this doesn't at all look like, I mean, this is supposed to be the evolution in time of a wave function, where the potential energy, where V was set to zero, where there is no potential energy, okay? Meaning, when the particle is free, when the particle we're studying, no forces act on it. So it should be just moving, along straight lines, not like this chalk, okay? Where is motion along straight lines in this convolution? It looks completely weird, okay? And it's lovely to spend some time and try to understand it. And you're welcome to do it. The hint is the following. So the thing that represents a particle at position x0 and a given momentum in quantum mechanics is a wave function that looks like a sine wave, which is centered around x0, and with wavelength inversely proportional to the momentum, or something like that. Now, of course, you cannot, in order to even say what I just said, the position of the particle cannot sit at position x0, it has to sit on some interval. Okay? And furthermore, if you have a sine wave with a limited, chopped to a limited interval, then its wavelength is not totally well defined. So basically, the thing that I've drawn here has neither well-defined position nor well-defined momentum, but it has approximately the position, you know, within this interval, and the momentum as well-defined as you can read off the frequency from just several wavelengths. Okay? But anyway, now you convolve this with the exponential of I times a quadratic. So you convolve this with a function that looks like this. So the quadratic, the quadratic looks like this, And if you exponentiate it, you get the phase that hardly changes at the beginning, and then it changes more and more and more rapidly as you go towards infinity. Sorry, this is very schematic. Okay? And then the point, well, what does convolution mean? It means that you translate this, and then you translate it on top of that, multiply and integrate. Okay? Now, most of the time, the frequency here will not match. You translate this, put it on top of it. Most of the time, the frequencies will not match. Okay? And therefore, you'll get, what is it called? Interference?
Destructive interference.
Destructive?
Yes.
No. Destructive?
That's what I've always called it.
Yeah, okay. And therefore, you'll get no contribution to the integral. So when you convolve, mostly the result will be fluctuating somewhere near zero. But then at one specific point, if you translate this by just the right amount, the frequency here will match the frequency here, you'll have constructive interference, and you'll have a blip. And this blip will move as t will change. Right? Because t basically changes the how quickly this compresses. And you're welcome to check that this motion is precisely the predicted motion from classical mechanics. So I mean, I'm just saying there's a large number of intricacies to understand here. Okay? Anyway, well, all of this is an aside. Now we want to prove the lemma. Okay? So I need to prove that the exponential of the Laplacian is convolution by a Gaussian. So in fact, we'll do that several times in the future in sort of slightly related contexts, but let's do it the first time. So in fact, the left-hand side is just the solution of Schrödinger's equation with no V. I guess I already said that. So the left-hand side, if you call it psi of tnx, satisfies this equation. Now, do Fourier transform, compute the Fourier transform of this equation with respect to the variable x. Okay? Now, the Fourier transform is linear, so it will commute with differentiation with respect to t. So if you take the Fourier transform relative to the variable x, as written here, then the left-hand side will be, the Fourier transform of it will be the derivative of psi, sorry, will be the derivative of the Fourier transform, so the derivative of psi tilde with respect to t. And the right-hand side will be the Fourier transform of the Laplacian applied to psi. And you know, Laplacian is differentiation squared, the Fourier transform of the differentiation is multiplying by x, by p, sorry, by the parameter of the Fourier transform called p. And if you have two derivatives, you'll get multiplication by p squared, and hopefully the constants are right. Okay? So at the Fourier transform level, you get this equation. But you see, this equation it's not a differential equation anymore, right? It's an ordinary differential equation, not a partial differential equation anymore. For any fixed p, if you fix p, then for that value of p, this is a ordinary differential equation for psi tilde at that point p. So you solve all of these infinitely many, R many, okay, the continually many differential equations at the same time, they're all simple derivative is equal to a constant times the function equations with given initial conditions, and then the solution is just the usual exponentiation, right? And now you take the inverse Fourier transform, and so now you go back from p to x, And again, you have to remember your analysis, and Fourier transform and also the inverse Fourier transform take multiplication to convolution. So I have to take the inverse Fourier transform of psi tilde, and I get psi zero, of psi zero tilde, and I get psi zero, convolved with the inverse Fourier transform of a Gaussian, which is again a Gaussian. This we will use many times later with more detail. Anyway, that proves the lemma. And now I can expand this messy expression to make it even messier. Okay? So what does this expression? So I have to evaluate at xn e to the Laplacian applied to something. Horrible. Oops. What did I do? Something wrong. Sorry about that. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry about that. Let's say it again. So I have to evaluate at xn e to the Laplacian applied to some mess, meaning the convolution of a Gaussian at xn with the result of the horrible computation here. So let's look at it. And I should have said that I've switched from calling the output from x, I just call it xn, okay, the output value of x. So I have to convolve a Gaussian with the result of something else. To convolve, I need a new variable, call it x prime. Except since I need many convolutions, instead of calling it x prime, I'll call it x sub n minus 1. So I get the integral dx n minus 1 of, well, here is the Gaussian, and the rest is the rest of the expression evaluated at x n minus 1. Now, what's the rest of the expression? Well, I have to apply the operator e to the it over nv to something and evaluate it at xn minus 1. But a multiplication operator is applied by simply by multiplying. So I multiply it by v at xn minus 1. Then I have to do yet another convolution. So I have to integrate dxn minus 2, and I'll have a Gaussian with x n minus 1 minus x n minus 2, blah, 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 and so on. So these are these three dots. And then the thing ends with the last convolution, which is an integration dx0, and the last, multiplication operator, which becomes exponentiation at v at x0, and the original function. Yes?
Does the constant depend on n?
The constant depends on n, yes. You're right. Okay. So maybe the word universal should not be here. Okay? It's too ambitious. Anyway, now let's repackage it. Okay? So it's a huge mess. Let's rewrite the mess in a slightly different way. So instead of having, well, I'll pull all the integrations out. So I have the constant and then integration dx0 up to dxn minus 1. And then all the things within the integral were exponents. So I'll multiply them and it will be the exponent of a sum. So here it is, the exponent of a big sum. Now, what is this big sum? So I have z evaluated at each of the x's, and we've multiplied by t over n, because each of the v's was in itself multiplied by t over n, and I hope the i's are right also. And I have a sum of xk minus 1 squared, and over here it's divided by 2t over n, and here I took the liberty to put a t over n inside a parenthesis before squaring, and then I have to put a t over n outside to cancel it. Okay? I mean, this is arithmetic, nothing exciting. Okay? But now comes the interesting part. So we have values x0 up to, in fact, xn, right? Xn is not integrated on, but it's there. It's the place where we evaluate the whole thing. So we have these values x0 up to xn, and instead of thinking of them as individual values, I'm thinking of them as defining the graph of a function, or of a polygon. What is it called? Piecewise linear. Thank you. Piecewise linear function. So the function which at time 0 is x0, at time t over n is x1, at time 2t over n is x2, and so on. And when you view it this way, right, when you view the whole collection of x's as defining a function, well, first of all, let me give this function a name. So I'll call this function x of t. Okay? And then what is written over here is, let's see, first of all, this is what is it called? The slope? X of t at one point, the minus x of t of a nearby point divided by the distance between the point. So this is an approximation to the derivative squared. So it's the derivative squared, and I sum the multiplied by the length of the interval t over n, and I sum over all positions. So this is a this is the Riemann approximation to the integral of the derivative squared. And likewise, this is a Riemann approximation, a Riemann sum approximation to the integral of v evaluated of v composed with the function x. Okay? So this is now written here. So when n goes to infinity, I pretend that I can replace this whole integral by the integral dx0, and then I'm separating out x0 because it plays a slightly different role. Okay? And then I integrate over the space of all functions, really for each specific n. It's the space of all polygonal functions. But as n goes to infinity, I think of it as if I'm integrating over the space of all functions called x. This calligraphic d means it's an infinite dimensional integral. It's a space, it's an integral over the space of all functions. It also means not well defined. Okay? Infinite dimensional integrals in general don't make sense. In this particular case, it can actually be made rigorous, but generally speaking, later on, it will not make sense, but it will be but it will lead to meaningful computations. So anyway, I integrate over the space of all such functions, living in the space wx0xn, where this is the space of all functions that begin at x0 and end at xn. Basically, you know, since xn and x0 were treated separately, I have to look at functions that are zero, that are x0 at 0 and xn at t. Okay? And then the integrand is the exponential of Well, the integral of the derivative of x squared minus the v composed with x. Okay? Are you with me? Okay, we've discovered path integrals. This is the thing called path integrals. Okay, so now, the thing that appears here looks deceptively similar to the Hamiltonian, but it's actually different. Okay, the sign here flips and it's not a typo. It's really a different thing. So the thing called the thing appearing here is often called the Lagrangian, or the and then the action of a path x is defined to be the integral of the Lagrangian from 0 to t. And then with this notation, our solution, the answer we seek, is the integral over dx0 of psi 0 of x0, I guess that appeared there at the end, times the integral over all paths beginning from x0 and ending at xn of e to the I times the Lagrangian. Okay? Are you with me? So far it looks like things have gone worse and worse. Okay? Now they'll start being easier. So, here's a general principle, and in fact we will use this principle later on in many places. When you study the integral of e to the if, so basically, well, suppose f looks like this. E to the if is going to, so e to the if is going to be fluctuating where f changes, and it's going to be relatively stationary, it's going to be fluctuating, I mean with varying, it's the phase is going to change. It's going to be relatively constant when f is flat, and then it's going to fluctuate again, right? Because motion here translates to fluctuations. Now, fluctuations tend to cancel each other, so the biggest contribution to the integral will come from the places where f is nearly constant, from the minimas and maximas of f. This is the so-called stationary phase principle. And of course, it can be made much more precise and much more detailed. And in fact, I'm not using it here. I will not be using it at all, except for inspiration. Okay? So, inspired by the stationary phase principle, instead of integrating, like, on a certain domain, you tend to put the place where the action is stationary in the center of the domain, and integrate around there, and study it as if it's in the center. So in other words, of all the paths in wx0 xn, of all the paths in the space of paths in which we integrate, I pick the one in which the Lagrangian attains its minimum. We'll see in a minute that such a path exists. And instead of integrating over arbitrary paths, I write an arbitrary path as the minimum plus path, the so-called classical path, plus the q correction to it, plus xq, where xq is a path which is zero at both ends, because I cannot change the endpoints. And then I rewrite the integral as an integral over paths that begin and end at zero. The integration variable is this variation path, and I integrate e to the il times xc plus xq. Now, the thing that comes next is particular to our extremely lucky situation. In general, it's false. Okay? in our particularly lucky situation, the Lagrangian written here is quadratic in x. Well, this is quadratic quite clearly. And v, well, v was half x squared. So this is also quadratic, half of the square. So this is also quadratic. Now, when you have a quadratic function, you can check that its value at the point where it's minimal plus a fluctuation is just, well, it's this. Okay? So, so therefore I can replace this by the sum of these two. Okay?
For small or for every?
Every. Generally speaking, had it not been quadratic, what I said is wrong. But for a quadratic Lagrangian, it's just simply true that the value at the, well, I mean, should we prove it?
Just intuition, why it's becoming linear.
What?
Why it's becoming linear, it's quadratic, and it's here it's written like linear.
But it's not linear, it's not linear. It's linear only near xc, where xc is the minimal point. So basically, what does a general quadratic look like? Okay? So, you know, let me do it in R, okay? Just to convince you that this is true, well, in the simplest case, and the general case will be. So what I'm claiming is that if you have a parabola, okay, and this is the place where it is minimal, okay, then, and if I look at, okay, if I add to it xq, then the value at xq will be, well, then the equation written over there holds. So you can, let's just verify it. So this parabola can be written as x minus a plus b, sorry, x minus a squared plus b. The minimal x, if you write it this way, it's just a. So I guess I could have written it as x minus xc squared plus b. So therefore, the value at xc is simply b. And the value at xc, sorry, xc plus xq is xq squared, sorry, xc plus, yeah, xq squared plus b. So it's xq squared plus x of, no, I think I've gone plus x of, sorry, plus L of xc. I've oversimplified. I told you I haven't done it in 15 years. It's even simpler. This is, I think this is essentially Pythagoras' law. Okay? Okay, what we have here is we have a quadratic function L of x defined globally on the space of all paths. Okay? So we have a, sorry, so that was a, sorry. We have a quadratic function, L of x, defined globally on the space of all paths. And within the space of all paths, we look at a subspace WX0XN, which is not a linear subspace, it's an affine subspace. Okay? So we look at an affine subspace, this is WX0XN, and then we look for the point in this affine subspace where the quadratic is minimal. So we look for the point where the quadratic function is minimal, and then the claim is that the value of the value of the quadratic at some point xc plus xq is the value of the quadratic at xc plus the value of the quadratic at xq, if you had translated xq to here. And I guess it's Pythagoras' theorem generalized to arbitrary quadratics.
Pythagorean theorem, you should have some kind of orthogonality of xc and xq.
So the orthogonality comes from the fact that I'm choosing xc to be the minimal value of the quadratic on this affine space. It's the place where it's sort of closest to the origin. Okay? Sorry, I... Okay. Anyway, so where are we? Right. So this is so the formula we now have is okay. You replace the Lagrangian at xc plus xq by the Lagrangian at xc plus the Lagrangian at xq, but the integration variable now is xq, and xc is fixed, so I can pull out e to the I lxc out of this of the second integral, and I'm left with the integral dx0, so this is just a finite dimensional, a single integral over the real numbers, of psi 0 at x0 times this quantity. This quantity depends on x0 because xc depends on x0 because the affine space we're looking at depends on x0. But then what remains is a single constant. It's an infinite dimensional integral, but it's independent. It does not depend on x0 or on psi 0. It's a constant. Okay, once and for all, a single integral, the integral over paths beginning at 0 and ending at 0 of e to the quadratic. Now, I don't know what this constant is, so I'll just call it c. Okay? So therefore, the answer is the psi at time t and position x is the integral dx0 of psi 0 times e to the I times the Lagrangian at the classical x. So at the x that minimizes the Lagrangian, the minimal value of the Lagrangian. Okay? Now we're back to classical mechanics. How do you minimize Lagrangians? And I suppose I will do it next time because I'm running out of time. But it's a classical problem, and the problem is, and the solution is, the solution is that there is a unique xc that minimizes the Lagrangian, and it's given by x0 cosine t plus xn sine t, and then when you you just compute explicitly, right? You take the Laplacian, integrate it, square it, and integrate it. Anyway, an easy explicit computation gives you that L at xc is negative x0 xn, and therefore psi at pi over 2 and x. Sorry, here I switched to t equals pi over 2. Is given by the integral of psi 0 at x0, dx0, against e to the minus x0 xn. Again, xn and x are synonyms. Okay? So in other words, but this is exactly the Fourier transform of psi 0. Right? So in fact, you see, this C here contains in it all the constants that we've neglected throughout, including this infinite dimensional integral. But at the end, since I've exponentiated something self-adjoint, I must get something unitary. So in fact, I know what C is. It must come out to be 1 over the square root of 2 pi. Otherwise, this will not be unitary. So, and the moral is that, you know, if you throw a particle into a quantum harmonic oscillator, you wait pi over 2 and you read the result, the result is the Fourier transform of what you started from. Now, for physicists, it should somehow not be so, well, I don't have time. Maybe I'll just say one more word. For mathematicians, the slightly surprising thing here is, you see, instead of waiting pi over 2, I could wait less or more. And then the moral is that there is a one-parameter group of operators which starts at the identity. At pi over 2, it's the Fourier transform. At pi, it's, well and so on. So basically, you can interpret, there are partial Fourier transforms, if you wish. And they are obtained by letting the particle sit for less time inside the harmonic oscillator. And our computation could give you explicit formulas, because all you have to do is, instead of minimizing at time equal pi over 2, you find the thing that minimizes the action at different times, and you'll get explicit formulas. And I think I owe you the proof of one lemma, and we'll do it next time. Okay.